Welcome to Blog Talk Radio in high fidelity.
Welcome to the Along Came a Writer Network. Opinions expressed in our shows do not necessarily reflect those of the network. Well, hello, all your fans of Mystery and Suspense. Welcome to Chat Noir, the Mystery and Suspense show that introduces you to the only slightly creepy folks who write it. We want to welcome Dr. Richard Mabry today. He writes medical suspense, and I'm going to read a little bit about him before I bring him on. Okay, he's a retired physician. Hence the doctor, who in addition to writing is a husband and grandfather. He plays and enjoys golf and does the 101 other things that retired people do. He got into non-medical writing after the death of his first wife with the book The Tender Scar, Life After the Death of a Spouse, and which is still in print and available to those who would love to read that. And now he writes medical suspense with heart. That's his tagline. His novels have been finalists in the ACFW Carroll Award, Romantic Times Best Inspirational Novel, and the Reviewer's Choice Award. And he's won the CELA and been named by Christian Retailing as the best in mystery, suspense, thriller category. His latest novel is Cardiac Event, which has been given a 4.5-star rating and a top pick by Romantic Times. He's also published 3 novellas, the latest one, Doctor's Dilemma. I want to welcome Dr. Richard Mabry to the show. Hi, Richard.
Linda, it's my pleasure.
Well, I wanted to start off just asking you, my only foray into medical suspense was Coma. That's where I started years ago. Okay, so tell us the truth. Was that feasible or even remotely accurate?
Oh, let's put it this way. If you don't mind suspending disbelief, it probably would work. But I'll be honest with you. That one was a little bit too creepy for me to finish.
Yeah.
I don't care for creepy fiction either. I write what Brandilyn Collins calls, she writes with the lights off on suspense. I write lights with the lights off suspense.
Well, I think real life situations are creepy, off, don't you? The movie Coma, well, the book, I read the book, Coma, and then, of course, the movie. And the scenes from the movie where people are suspended, from the ceiling, that's been copied so many times. And, and now, gosh, in this day and age, it seems like things you write about that are sort of futuristic are coming to pass in so many ways. What inspired you to start writing medical suspense? I know you were probably too busy while you were a practicing doctor.
Oh, no question. I had no idea that I would ever write anything in the non-medical realm, any non-medical writing. I had done, I had either written or edited textbooks before retiring and so forth, but I kind of got into this, I backed into it. After Cynthia died, I wanted to write about my experiences. So finally, an editor took pity on me and said, you really ought to go to a Christian writer's workshop, which I did. At that point, Jim Bell and Al Gansky sort of challenged me to try my hand at fiction. You don't challenge a man to do something, whether it's bowling or golf or writing, without his doing it. So
That's
I tried,
right.
and 4 years and 4 unsuccessful novels that got 40 rejections later, I was an overnight success. So I wrote in the medical field because that's what I knew. And it finally occurred to me, hey, idiot, you really ought to write this because you know the medical field, and you can make it logical. You can make it to where the average individual, average reader will follow along. And so that's what I tried to do.
Did you find it difficult at first, not writing proper scientific sentences?
Oh, yes. Matter of fact, one of my mentors, one of the people whose class I took at a workshop I took, said that you almost have to unlearn everything that you've learned about writing in the proper form, because that's not the way you write fiction. And sure enough, it really does require some re-education.
Yeah, you're right. You do have to throw it all out and start over, an English
major. I was an English minor.
And you was. You were. Yeah, you see. Now, do you have a favorite mystery writer, modern, or you can go as far back as you want?
There are many, many of them that I like, many that I read. But I have a couple of bookcases that are full of some of the older novels. Robert B. Parker, for instance, the late Robert B. Parker, who wrote the Spencer series, is one of my favorites. But I will reread his. I'll reread Ross Thomas's and so forth. I'll even go back and look at some of the Agatha Christie's, because I have always enjoyed some of these older novels. Now, I'm always looking for a new one, but when I want to, well, for instance, when Cynthia was in the ICU, I reread all of Robert Parker's books because I could kind of be transported away from the current events and just to let my mind wander as I lost myself in his writing.
Right, it sort of takes you out of your present mm-hmm. circumstance.
That's the whole idea, I think, behind this kind of,
I think
this
so
kind
too.
Of writing is, yeah.
Well, and also sitting there trying to figure it out, to figure out what's going to mm-hmm. happen next. And it's lovely when you can't figure it out.
Well, I learned this trick from Donald Westlake. He writes what he calls push fiction. I've never heard that term before.
No.
But Westlake does not know, nor do I, who the bad guy is when he starts a book. He doesn't know how it's going to end up. Now Jim Bell says that you should have a knockout ending. And I roughly know how it's going to end, but I don't know who the bad guy is going to be. And Westlake says that if I don't know how it's going to end, then the reader can't know how it's going to end either.
Well, you know, this may seem like a crazy thing to say, but to people who don't write, but do your characters sort of lead you in the way to go? I mean, nothing mm-hmm. nothing weird, but you know your characters, especially in a series, and they kind of lead you.
There's no question that they do something, and I have learned over the years to try to have them do things that I don't expect. And that's always nice, too. I still like the story that Jim Bell tells. He had a character in one of his books, and he decided that character has to be killed off. And his editor said, excuse me, I really hated it that you killed off such and such. And he said, well, I didn't really kill him off. I found him dead. And so that's what I do, you know.
Well,
I let my characters tell me.
Do you sit around daydreaming about ways you're going to off someone in a book? Because you have to get creative.
Oh, yes. Matter of fact, you know as well as I One of the more interesting conversations is one that you overhear at a fiction writer's workshop. You know, if you hear the elevator conversation at ACFW or go to International Thriller Writers, and one writer of my acquaintance says that if anyone ever gets hold of her browser history, they're probably going to arrest her.
Yeah, it's not going to look good.
No, not at all.
I know I should go to you and sometimes and see if what I'm coming up with is feasible. But for my fight scenes, I always go to Carla Hoke because she teaches fight right and does mixed martial arts for real. So I'll ask her if that works or not.
You can actually get a lot of medical information from Doug Lau, D.P. Lau. He has a really wonderful website that talks about poisons and shootings and stabbings and things like that. And it's really nice to read through his stuff periodically.
What's his website called so that any of our writers who are listeners can go to it?
If you just Google Dr. D.P. Lau, L-Y-L-E, you'll find it. I don't know offhand what the website is.
Okay.
Can't remember. It has something to do with medical problems.
Well, that's enough for us to get to it. That's awesome. So how long did it take before you got your first contract, and where were you? I mean, do you always remember that moment?
Oh, yes. I remember it very well. I was actually on vacation. My wife and I were on vacation. We had a timeshare in North Carolina. I had just about given up on my writing and on ever getting a contract. And I got a call, which was a miracle in and of itself, because self service was not that good where we were outside Asheville at Lake Fleur. But I got a contract from Barbara Scott, who was just starting the fiction line at Abingdon. And I was very fortunate. I subsequently had, four and three, I guess seven of my novels were published by Abingdon. But I still remember the call, and it took a while for it to soak in. I didn't really realize all that was happening. I had always worked toward getting that first contract, but after the first contract, it's kind of like stepping on a merry-go-round, and all of a sudden, you're going as fast as you possibly can and have three things thrown at you at the same time.
Edits.
Oh, yes.
And of course, for that first contract, they could ask you, you don't know what you just signed, but you signed it.
No,
I figured as long as I wasn't selling my soul, I was good.
You know, that first contract is like the iTunes user agreement. Do you know anybody
yes.
who ever reads it?
No. No, but one of my contracts I did read, later contracts I read, and it had a clause about if there was an amusement park named after this book, that they would have the rights to it. And I thought, well, that's odd, but they've covered everything, haven't they?
Oh, good grief. I don't think I
know.
You know, now you make me want to go back and reread my contracts.
Yeah, you might find something interesting in there.
I found something very interesting. Yeah. But that first contract, people don't realize that the first contract may be a multi-book contract. It may just be for one book.
Yes.
I think actually this one was one book with an option for two more. And then they gave me an option for two more. And then my fourth one, Barbara said, well, I'm going to retire, but I want to do one more of yours before I retire. So let's do another one. And then I got an offer from my next publisher, which was very nice. And then Abingdon took me back. So people don't realize that you don't stay with the same publisher the whole time. Now, some people do,
right.
But I don't.
That's true. Or some people, you know, they do, but then the publishing business isn't there anymore, you know, to continue,
oh, yes.
which is sad as well.
Well, you and I both have You and I both have friends whose contracts have been voided when the publisher decided, oh, I'm going to close down the Christian fiction line.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. It's true. So what advice would you give to a beginning author who is in your same situation?
Read as much as you can. Read the good stuff so that you'll know what you should write. Read the bad stuff so you'll know what you should not do. Write and then have it reviewed by somebody other than your Aunt Tilly, who obviously thinks that you are just a genius. Have it reviewed by somebody who knows what they're doing. Revise, rewrite, have it reviewed again. Lather, rinse, and repeat. Just keep on doing. And then after that, it's rear end and chair, fingers on keyboard. Be persistent.
That's it. Yeah. Don't give up. Yeah. Don't give up. Yeah. Even though it's a lot harder for people, you know, aspiring authors to get published these days, if you're persistent, you just might.
I looked at Romantic Times reviews today, and just the new books in the inspirational area, they probably had a dozen or a dozen and a half, and there are many, many more that Romantic Times won't even review. So when you figure that there are literally thousands and thousands and thousands of books out there, you feel like you're a voice crying in the wilderness. How do you get people to notice you?
Well, yeah, I mean, out of the millions and millions on Amazon alone, you know, how do you get discovered? So what are the elements that make a good mystery suspense or medical suspense if someone's going to write that?
The first element, and one that people don't think too much about, when I didn't think about it when I was first starting, was they have to write characters with whom the individual can identify. It may be somebody that they like. It may be somebody that they hate. But they can at least identify. They are three-dimensional. They are characters that seem real. And then they have to have a goal. You don't know what the goal is, but they should be, as Jim Bell, who is one of my mentors, says, they have to be facing death of some sort, whether it's physical, whether it's emotional, whether it's professional, whatever it is, there has to be some kind of a conflict, and then you carry them along and don't get into trouble with the sagging middle, which we all are taught to avoid, and then some kind of a roundup at the end that will leave the people satisfied. You don't necessarily answer all the questions, but you answer most of them, or you save some of them. If it's a series, especially, you save some of them for later.
You know, and that's a good point that you make as a writer, but also as a reader. There's nothing I hate worse than not having all the ends tied up. You know, when I get to the end of a book. Now, if it's a series, I'm hoping that once I get to the next book, you know, maybe they'll continue or, you know, explain something. But if they don't, if they leave me without an answer, I kind of feel cheated, don't you?
Oh, I do. And especially if they don't at least address it, like, well, why did such and such happen? We'll never know that. Or I don't know that, or we'll investigate later. But if they just totally ignore it, a lot of times that indicates that the author forgot it. And let's face it, sometimes the authors do forget things. That's why you have to have a good editor, a good second reader.
Well, it's true. And I find when I'm writing, if too much time goes in between, you know, like if you get a contract on something else and you can't get back and there's too much time in between, I'll write what I think is a really good sentence. And then I'll go back and find that I already wrote that 2 months ago. It's
That's
like
why
in
it's
my
so
head.
Good. That's why it sounds so good.
Yeah. But it is true, you know, you need, and that's why it's good if you can do it all in one bunch, you know, if you can just, you know, just go through it. Now you're writing something now. Your current work in progress is Strong Medicine. How much can you tell us about
actually,
it?
Well, I can tell you a fair amount about it. This one probably won't come out for a year or so. I've got another novella and another novel in the queue before it. But Strong Medicine, I wondered what I could do with, how can I say this without turning everybody off? My wife thinks I should never publish this. A guy who opens up an old Albertson store and establishes what he calls Faith Tabernacle. And he preaches and has healing services. And then one night, his henchman, for lack of a better word, comes in and says, well, problem with the lady who was in the wheelchair that you healed tonight. What kind of problem? Well, it wasn't one of ours. You really did. You must have really healed her. This one features this guy whose life changes. Things were going along just fine till a miracle fouled him up, is the tagline. But it also features a guy who is a failed physician who has decided to go to seminary, and also another physician who is in practice, but she is burned out. The story, the novella, is how those three stories intertwine, and eventually there is what I hope is a satisfying ending.
You know, that is really fascinating. And I think it's funny that you mentioned that it's an old Albertsons, because we had an old Kroger mm-hmm. out here in the Woodlands mm-hmm. and somebody started mm-hmm. a church in it. And I thought, wouldn't it be neat if they, the fruit and vegetable section, they made the fruits of the spirit. They called it the fruits of the spirit. I just thought that's how my mind works. But, that sounds like a fascinating plot. So, and you'll have just enough time to get it all together. And is it going to be like a 20,000 word novella or something a little bit?
Probably about 25,000. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's the difference. You know, as well as I do, that novellas, I think, are harder to write than novels, because you have to, you follow one primary trail, so to speak, with maybe a couple of side ones if you're really ambitious, but you've got to get in and get out and use a smaller cast of characters too.
True. It's challenging. And then I took it down to the 5,000 or 6,000 short story, and that's even harder. Mm-hmm. And you want to go off on some more trails, you know, because you want to mm-hmm. throw in red herrings yeah. and all that. But which, if anyone doesn't know what that means, you know, that's to throw someone off the trail, yeah. if you're listening. Mm-hmm. So would you ever consider going into another genre, like a fiction, or maybe, you know, going back and forth into nonfiction?
I asked my agent about this when I was first getting started. And she said, as long as you have an audience and as long as people like what you're writing and the way that you write it, no, I wouldn't change. However, I look at people like, for instance, John Grisham, who went off into other books, Playing for Pizza, for instance, which is a short book about a guy who goes to Italy and plays professional football over there. I'm not sure that I'll ever be like John Grisham or Robert B. Parker, some of those who have enough followers that I can go off. But I guess I'm too chicken in one sense. I hate to leave the comfort of writing what I know and what I've learned how to do. But eventually, I think it'd be fun.
Yeah, I mean, no secret passion to write speculative fiction or romance.
No, speculative fiction is something I neither read nor write, and romance. theoretically, what I write is about 30% romance and 65 to 70% mystery. I like to say there's enough romance to keep the interest of the reader, but not enough that a male reader will vomit or throw it down, you know. So that's kind of what I do.
I sort of think the elements of a good book always include mystery and romance.
Mm-hmm.
That's my theory.
Sure.
What do you think? Yeah, I mean, because there's a definite mystery about a person or whatever, and romance can't hurt because, mm-hmm. you know, most of the readers out there are women, and they love a little romance in there. Now, let's talk about running out of time.
You may have heard the theory that 85% of the women who read either Christian or I think the new term is inspirational fiction, 85% of the readers are female.
Oh, what? Well, you know, the last I heard it was 80%. So I must have gone up.
We're close. Yeah.
Wow. Well, we have 5 minutes, well, four now, left to talk about cardiac arrest. And I'm just going to read the blurb and then you tell me what it was like writing it or tell us something about it.
Okay.
Cardiologist Dr. Kirk Martin continually crosses swords with Dr. Cliff Hamilton, so he is surprised when Hamilton asks him to care for him after a heart attack. When he's ready for discharge, Hamilton is found dead in his hospital bed, and Martin is suspected of murdering him. After another doctor is found shot to death, Martin's girlfriend, Nurse Janet Rush, reminds him to be careful because he may be next. Can he save his own life while searching for the identity of the real murderer? Okay, how were you inspired to write that? I mean, do you get it off the news, or which that's inspiration enough? Or did you just come up with the plot?
No, as you know, I was inspired initially by Alton Gansky, who taught me to ask, what if? You know, my thought was, I think I was reading a report of a cardiologist, and I thought, well, this guy is kind of protective of what he does. What if he had a doctor who occasionally crossed the line because he had been sort of trained in that area? And then everybody knows that there's enmity between the two. What if the older doctor asked the younger one to take care of him when he has a heart attack? He's literally holding this guy's life in his hands. He could kill him if he wants to. Nobody's saying anything about it. Just a medical misadventure. But then when he does die, the younger doctor is accused of being his murderer. And it sort of went from there. I let the character speak to me. And I put in some other people and the chief of staff and some of the emergency room doctors and so forth. So it's interesting to me, and of course, I did not know who the bad guy was when I started writing it. So that always is interesting to me to see how it comes out too.
Well, gosh, now we're running out of time, but the first question that would come to my mind as a reader is, why does Hamilton want Dr. Martin to take care of him if they're at odds?
He's the best guy around. And just because they've had their differences doesn't mean that he shouldn't ask him to do what he does. Martin is a cardiologist, and actually he can put stents in and so forth and get the man over his heart attack.
Okay, now we are running out of time. How can readers find you?
rmabry.com is my website. rmabry.blogspot.com is my blog, which is a Tuesday, Thursday thing. I'm on Facebook, R. Mabry Books, Twitter, Richard Mabry. I'm not hiding, but that's where I am.
Okay, so they can find you, and your books are offered everywhere where fine books can be found.
Well, this cardiac event is right now on Amazon, because it was independently published. Eventually it will be available, I think, in other areas.
Well, thank you so much. Thank you, Richard. It's been a joy having you on the show. Thank you, listeners, for tuning in to Chat Noir, Mystery and Suspense.